Welcome to episode 15 of Extra Sequential, your weekly dose of comic book podcasty goodness. About talking all about graphic novels and manga and the wide world of geeky comic-y stuff. My name's Mladen. I'm joined by Chris over the Skype network, thanks to the internet.
Yes, we are coming at you from Perth in Western Australia.
Yes, we just couldn't be bothered to meet today.
No, I'm a bit too lazy, plus I'm doing Movember, so I'm looking vaguely hairy, and I didn't want you to see me in my dishevelled form.
Are you sort of in that in-between stage of sort of having a moustache and sort of not?
Well, it's quite wispy, but it's light, and so it's not dark enough. So
yeah, that's no good.
Might have to get some mascara or something on it.
That's not going to work.
I know. There's a bunch of news that we're going to talk about today. We're also going to talk about some reviews. We're going to be talking about Toy Story, How Kion, Atomic Robo. We're going to be talking about the new Grant Morrison documentary as well that's just been released.
That's right. And we're also talking about Mesmo Delivery, cool European book I picked up here. And I'll be reviewing The Unwritten, the new Vertigo series.
Yes, good things. Well, let's get straight into the news, shall we? Firstly, on Comic-Con tickets, there was a delay, actually, in Comic-Con tickets for San Diego, which is the biggest pop culture comic book convention in the world. Well, actually not in the world, because the European ones are bigger. About 125,000 people in general. I've been a couple of times, and it is awesome. The Comic-Con tickets for next year go on sale on the 22nd of November. At 6 a.m. Pacific time, 9 a.m. Eastern time, 2 p.m. Greenwich Mean time. Currently,
Greenwich, get your tickets early.
Yes. Currently, 4-day memberships with preview nights, which is on the Wednesday nights. They're all sold out, but you can still get the 4-day memberships without the preview night. They're available. They're about $105 for adults. So Comic-Con isn't until late July of 2011, but the tickets just go undeniably and unbelievably quick. So November 22nd, and it's just comiccon.org, I believe. So jump on there if you want to go to Comic-Con 2011, and good luck to you, and may you have a lot of patience.
Are you going?
It's expensive. I mean, it's about $5,000 just because, and it's about 20 hours minimum in the flight coming from Perth to
That's anywhere. A long haul from Australia. For anyone who's not traveled to Australia, it's probably one of the worst flights
in the world. Long trip. I won't. I think I've gone twice, and that's enough for me. I think I wouldn't mind going to some smaller, maybe the New York Comic Con, or maybe even the Ape, which is more of the independent exhibition, or maybe the WonderCon. There's pretty much a convention in America every month. But Comic-Con is almost too big. It's just, and obviously people complain because it's all about, you know, Twilight and Harry Potter, not so much comic stuff. That's not entirely true. There's always comic stuff in Comic-Con. It's more Hollywood geared these days. But it's fun. I really enjoy it. But, yeah, it's a lot of money. It's a lot of time. If I lived in America, I'd be a bit more inclined, I should think.
Yeah, okay. We have some local cons, don't we? Supernova.
We do. The Supernovas are good.
They're growing. That's the thing.
They are growing, and they're getting good guests. We had Elijah Dushku this year, and a few other film and TV stars that I can't remember. But once you're in a Comic-Con, everything else kind of pales in comparison.
that little New Zealander kid who was in the Star Wars prequels.
Oh, yes, Daniel.
Very exciting. I think we had Jake, you know, little Anakin Skywalker one year, little Jake Lloyd.
We did, yes. And he was saw him, yes.
I saw, like, his he was sort of sitting at the signing booth. I don't think anyone was coming up to him, which was kind of sad.
It's kind of sad once you've had your moment in the sun and then what happens. But especially, I mean, it's hard to make such have longevity in Hollywood, you know. So I guess a lot of them go off and do different things.
Well, he's also one of the worst child actors in the world. So.
Well, he's not a child anymore, so it might be good.
He was one of the worst. What happened to Haley Joel Osment? He just sort of faded away, didn't he?
Yeah, that's true.
He was freaking amazing.
Oh, he did the voice of Astro Boy in the CGI film, didn't he?
Oh, wow. Did he?
I think so.
Oh, I'm going to have to Google the hell out of that.
Yeah.
Sorry to excuse my typing. But other news items. We did our review of Superman Earth 1 last week.
Yes.
None of us really cared for it, I would say is fair.
But you know who loved it? everybody else except us, apparently, because it's been going to a second printing and a third printing. And I think I can guess what you're going to say next, but JMS, the writer, J. Michael Straczynski, is doing a sequel, which you hinted at last week, so you were correct.
Thank you, sir. Points for me.
He's basically walking away from monthly comics. So he's stepping away from Superman 707 and Wonder Woman 605, and other scripters will be coming in to do that.
Yep, Chris Robinson and Phil Hester will be taking over Superman and Wonder Woman, respectively.
Interesting choices, I've got to say.
I'm not familiar with their work.
So that starts in January. Chris Robinson does Fables work. He did the Cinderella miniseries.
Ah, okay.
Phil Hester's done a lot of DC work, mainly on Green Arrow. And I think he's, let's have a look here, Eddie Barrows, I believe. Robertson will be joined by guest artist Alan Goldman on issue 707 and regular artist Eddie Barrows, who's done a lot of Superman work, Superman 708. And that'll basically tie off the grounded storyline that JMS started with Superman walking around the suburbs of America, which no one seems to be particularly interested by.
Goodbye to it.
And Phil Hester, as I said, has done Green Arrow and Nightwing. So 605 will be co-penciled by Eduardo Panseca. And he'll be the artist on issue 606. And then Don Kramer, who's the current artist on Wonder Woman, will return to full duties on issue 607. So this isn't going to happen until January, Superman and Wonder Woman. But, yeah, effectively, JMS is just going to do the sequel to Earth One and other graphic novels and miniseries, because he says that that's going to... that's where his most success has lied. And just Earth One has just been phenomenally successful. Amazon sold out in a day. Bookshops are selling out all over the place. It'll be interesting. What do you think?
I'm just surprised this book's doing that well. I think there's just a lot of hype around it and a lot of curiosity. And comic fans tend to buy things usually on a whim. Like, I know a lot of people who just hate reading reviews. Like, once they've made their mind up that they're interested, they won't read anything, especially if it's negative.
Yeah.
And it seems like every other review I see of it's usually just underwhelmed. They give it, like, you know, basically a C grade, so passable, you know. But I guess people are curious about the hardcover format. A lot of I'm assuming a lot of people who don't want to invest in a weekly, or what? How often do the Superman comics come out? Like, weekly?
Monthly.
Monthly,
yeah.
Sorry. A monthly pamphlet thing. Just want to grab a story done in one.
Yeah.
Just feel like they're jumping on that character. But yeah, I had another look recently at, because we both looked at that Grant Morrison doco. I had a brief glance at his All-Star Superman again, and it's just light years above.
It is.
This book, so.
It is. And I think, it is a bit of a novelty of sorts, because, I mean, DC don't do a lot of hardcover original graphic novels. It's very rare that they'll do them, that Marvel or DC will do that thing. I mean, they'll do trades, which compile previously published miniseries, but to do an original graphic novel that'll go to bookstores and everything and that it's accessible to newbies is quite rare.
Yeah.
So I guess all the people that are buying it aren't jaded fanboys like myself, but people that are curious about Superman and want to see what he's up to.
I think there's a lot of entry-level fanboys, if you know what I mean, who have picked up some main titles and don't really know a whole lot about what's going on, so they figure, well, this will do. And for them, it doesn't feel tired and hokey because they haven't read any other Superman.
No, that's true.
Yeah. But speaking of original graphic novels coming out of DC, there's been these question marks up in the air of what's going to happen with Vertigo. And I know these last couple of months, we can't assume that this is a part of a trend because, I mean, these books would have been organized years in advance, you know, for the editorial. But they've got a lot of original graphic novels coming out lately.
Okay.
And people are sort of questioning whether, with all the editorial layoffs with Vertigo. Yep. Vertigo, by the way, is the publisher behind Sandman, The Invisibles.
Fables.
DMZ, Fables, like all... a lot of the very popular books, Preacher, that kind of thing. And we'll be talking about The Unwritten later.
Yep.
Yeah, just sort of... I'm querying whether they're just going to... Because Vertigo comics tend to not do great, and then in trade they sell really well.
Yeah.
Well, they do okay, but not enough to justify. Because I know the Vertigo comics, they're sort of matching the print quality of their main DC line.
Okay.
And with the cost involved of printing books on that quality paper and the colours, the colour process they use, I don't think it's economically feasible. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, they're award-winning books and very popular, but they're not making them as much money as they should.
And I guess Vertigo is a lot more accessible than in the main DC line of superhero books. Mm-hmm. So it kind of makes sense.
And seeing how in the last couple of years the graphic novel sales all across the board have been climbing while pamphlet sales have been sort of staying steady, but I guess they're sort of leaning down slightly. You can understand why they would make that sort of change on Vertigo. It's just that we hope they don't trash the line in the process and cancel any more titles, because there was a period where they were just cancelling titles left and right.
That's true.
I was halfway through The Exterminators, and and then they just like had to wrap it up in two issues, and it was just dismal. Very upsetting. And also on DC, have you heard they launched their digital comic store?
Yes. Mm. I haven't even looked at it, to be honest.
Yeah.
But, so what does that mean? You could buy, obviously, this is the place to go for, is it iPhone and stuff?
Yeah, iPhone apps, okay, just to read the comics online. And I've noticed they've been putting out a lot of first issues of series. So finally, all these people who are like, well, what's this series? I don't want to spend, because you can't get original issue ones anymore. You have to invest in the trade if you want to just get a flavor of, say, Preacher or Sandman or something.
Yeah,
they can sell that first issue to you online. I don't know what the price is. I'm assuming it's around the dollar mark. That's what I'd spend.
Yeah, I think most comics are about that, like the 99 cents. I'm just looking at now. So it's read.dccomics.com/comicsology. Comicsology is the pretty much one of the main apps reading comics digitally, and it looks like they've got mainly most of their superhero stuff up there at the moment. They've also Vertigo books, new releases. There's a few free comics. It's about time DC did this. Marvel have been doing this kind of thing for a while.
Marvel have
looks like
their
comics are $1.99. And that's American, so not too bad. No, there's a few previews and stuff. Yeah, I haven't really had a look at it, but because this news only hit a couple of days ago. But good on DC. I mean, it's an interesting stuff what's happening to DC lately. Just all, like I said, their Lars, the Vertigos, the film line, and now the original graphic novels. Now they're going digitally. I mean, it's an exciting time to be a DC fan, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot of cross media things happening. It's all they're all trying to modernize and make a buck. But so far they haven't done anything too atrociously, like, oh, I can't believe they're doing that, you know.
No more than
usual, anyway.
That is true.
But speaking of those kind of things, I guess Marvel's following suit with the death of Batman by having the death of Spider-Man?
Yes, the death of Spider-Man. That's all it is at the moment. I think it's for the cover that was released for the February previews catalogue. So that'll be coming out in December. For February releasing products, and the cover of the Marvel previews just says The Death of Spider-Man. And it's interesting because a couple of days ago, DC also had their Bleeding S logo, Superman logo, saying that Doomsday will reign or something. So I don't know if Doomsday is the big scary monster that killed Superman, who was seen in the ninth season of Smallville as well recently.
Played by Chris Pine,
Doomsday, what's that?
Played by Chris Pine. No?
Played by the guy from Star Wars Force Unleashed 2.
Oh, that guy?
Yeah.
As Doomsday?
Oh, yeah.
What?
He was like human, but he would transform into Doomsday, and he didn't know he was doing it. And So it's quite a different origin from the comics, but it still looked okay for a TV show. I mean, the prosthetics and stuff kind of worked. Superman, we don't know what's happening with Doomsday, if he's returning. Spider-Man may be killed. I don't know.
He'll be killed and come back, and people will buy it, and everyone will be happy.
Yeah.
I just don't care. No. I just thought I'd mention it. But speaking of, not speaking of deaths, but the time of our lives passing, Neil Gaiman's turned 50 on November 10th.
Really?
Happy birthday, Neil.
Yeah, actually, I didn't realize Grant Morrison is actually 50 years old as well. I just wikied him after watching that documentary, and he said he's 50 years old. So those guys look pretty young, a pastable comic book writer.
Damn right.
Yeah, we should get in on that action.
What, turning 50?
I already look 50, and I'm 34.
Yeah, you've got that Robin Williams disease.
Robbie Williams?
Robin Williams from that movie Jack.
Oh, right.
Does no one talk about that movie Jack anymore?
I do remember. Wasn't the nanny woman in that? Fran Drescher? I don't know.
You know, she may have been. I think she tried to seduce him in a bar, and he's like 9 years old.
Wow.
I don't want to talk about that movie.
I do believe you. Let's talk about Tintin.
Yeah. These pictures have been floating around online. You should just Google Tintin movie picks. There's been quite a few going up around at Empire, put a few out. A few have been just released online. And they're the first look at Peter Jackson's and Steven Spielberg's motion-captured 3D extravaganza of Tintin. Tintin being the he's Belgian, isn't he? Yeah, the Belgian creation of Hergé, and from the 60s and 70s, and it's sort of still been a popular seller. We were talking about how many issues they sold a while ago, and it's, you know, it's in the hundreds of millions, you know, in 70 different languages, that sort of deal. It's incredibly popular internationally and not so much in the US, so a lot of people have been querying, why is he doing this film? It just looks like a typical adventurer. And I've been like, Tintin's a big deal, dudes. Like, just, I think this film would do very well internationally, maybe. But I guess we should talk about the pictures. What's your reactions to them?
It's supposed to come out in October 2011. It's called The Adventures of Tintin, Secret of the Unicorn. The pictures look good. I'm not that familiar with Tintin, so I'm not really one to pass comment. But the voice cast, or the motion capture cast that they've lined up is pretty good. Like you said, Andy Serkis from Lord of the Rings is Captain Haddock. Daniel Craig is Red Rackham.
Yeah.
The Thompson twins are being played by Simon Pegg and Nick Frost.
The voices of the characters still look like their characters. And Jamie Bell from... what's his face? Billy Elliot. Fame is playing Tintin.
Yeah.
Billy Elliot and Jumper. Those are his two.
I like the idea of Simon Pegg and Nick Frost.
That'll be good,
As the Thompson twins are obviously identical, but the actors who play them aren't. Yeah, it looks pretty good. It looks almost like a quite dark, pulpy, noirish kind of...
Yeah, Tintin was always a little... Like, the pictures from the comic, you might think it is quite lighthearted, but there's murders and some quite creepy stuff that happens in there, especially one where this Aztec mummy sort of seems to be alive and killing people. And this particular series, I think, was two comics, Secret of the Unicorn and Red Rackham's Treasure. And, of course, it was about a pirate's treasure, and one of Captain Haddock's ancestors was the pirate... So there's flashbacks to of like 1750 of like how he dies, and so the film will explore that. And it looks like they're combining stuff from a few of the other comics here and there. What they've done with the mocap is, I guess, a little bit of blend of the dude from Back to the Future's films. I can't remember his name now. You know, the Christmas one that he did with Tom Hanks, and the other one he did with Tom Hanks.
Robert Zemeckis,
and all those Tom Hanks 3D movies.
Yes.
And they've sort of twisted people's physical bodies, so their legs are very short and their heads are bigger than they should be, and just to make them look more comic-y.
Yep.
So some of the long pictures, they look like figurines.
Yeah.
Like very well-rendered figurines. I'm kind of worried this film will be quite a big flop, but I don't know how much money they've really put into this. So, what do you think?
It'll be a big hit in Europe, I'd imagine. But kind of, I don't know why they just didn't do a live action. But it does kind of look a bit. It looks slightly askew, doesn't it? Just looking at these pictures, and I noticed they haven't released hardly any pictures of Tintin's face, but just all the other characters. But from the cover of Empire magazine,
you can see his face. I think he's probably the best realized character out of all of them. Like, his face to me looks the best out of them. Captain Haddock's just looks a bit weird, but yeah, personally, like, just from my personal view, my first reaction after seeing that cover was great. He looks spot on to me.
And it does look very much like the comic,
And he had that sort of bright look in his face, which I thought really, like, if he looked weird, the main character looked weird, I wouldn't buy it, you know. But I could probably live with Captain Haddock looking a bit bizarre, but I know Andy Serkis can pull off that character. He's done pirates before in King Kong.
Yes.
And Jamie Bell was in that as well.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And it's written by Stephen Moffat, Edgar Wright, and Joe Cornish. So it's quite a European and English...
Edgar Wright? Really?
Cast, yeah, apparently.
Wow. I had no idea.
I'm at a site, as we speak, called Tintinology.
Oh, and, okay. It's like a Tintin Wiki.
What's that?
Is it like a Tintin Wikipedia?
It looks like a big fan page, but all the various information. But, yeah, it looks pretty cool. I guess it's kind of be an all ages kind of.
Yeah, it'll be. I just wanted to bring up a strange sort of phenomenon I've seen on message boards when these pictures come up, and there's a strange amount of resentment. I don't know if you've noticed this, like a lot of anger from people looking at this who haven't read the comic, and they're really angrily declaiming it and saying, "What is this fluff?"
Because they have no idea what Tintin is, and
they're just sort of wondering what is this? Is just some pulpy character? Why is Spielberg wasting his time on this? And I'm like, well, okay. Indiana Jones people, that was a pulpy character. But I'm just sort of baffled by it.
I guess because it's a kid. Yeah. It's kind of rugged man with a whip, so they automatically think it's more of a kid's film. But
Well, it could, even if it is a kid's film, Spielberg's done some of the best kid's films of all time, or the most memorable kid's films. I mean, even if they haven't aged too well, like Goonies is pretty unwatchable now, but so many kids, like, well, kids, I say kids, but now we're like 20-something.
Yeah.
But so many of us who grew up with Goonies, it's, or like Hook, which again has not aged well and looks pretty bad if you watch it now, but that was a... Those were big deals.
I watched Goonies recently, and that was awesome. The 25th
really?
Or whatever anniversary edition's out now, and so I was the Back to the Future. And I actually watched the Lost Boys, the third Lost Boys film last night.
There's three of them? I've only watched the first one.
No, there's two more. They did one about 2 years ago, and then the last one. And they had a last little tribute to Corey Haim.
Is he in any more of them besides the first one?
Sorry? Corey Feldman. Well, he died, but Corey... My Corey's mixed up.
Corey Feldman, yep.
Is alive, so he's in all of them.
Of Goonies,
that's
fame,
the Frog Brothers. In all, also in Goonies.
Mm.
No, was film in Goonies? I think only Corey Haim was in Goonies.
You're blowing my mind. Hold on, I'm googling this right now. Corey Feldman, Goonies.
Corey Haim was the pretty boy.
It feels like he was in it. He was definitely in it.
Corey Haim.
Corey Feldman
was in Goonies.
Yeah.
Okay.
Watch it again, and Samwise Gamgee from Lord of the Rings is in it.
Sean Astin, yep.
Samwise Gamgee, that's his actual name. And that little Short Round from Indiana Jones.
Oh, yes.
Mr. Jones, that guy.
That's the one. Apparently he's a martial arts choreographer now.
Good on him. He still looks 12. I've seen. So are we about done for news?
I was going to mention, actually, there's the Walking Dead TV series.
Ah, yes.
By AMC, by US Network, AMC, have renewed The Walking Dead based on the Image Comics series for a second season. So it just debuted on Halloween.
Yeah.
So they've ordered a 13th episode, second season, and it had more adults in the key 18 to 49 age group than any other show in the history of cable TV.
Yeah, it was a huge premiere.
5.5 million viewers for the debut, so that's astronomical. So it's aired in England as well, but it has yet to air in Australia here. But you could actually watch the pilot for free online for a brief time frame if you're an American resident. If you like a zombies, Walking Dead, it's been wonderfully. Also, very quickly, the Batman Live stage show. It's called the World Arena Tour. Have you heard about this?
My anticipation is ever so high for this piece of junk.
The Spider-Man Broadway musical has been delayed yet again until January, so this is probably a good opportunity. It's written by Alan Burnett and with some guidance from Geoff Johns, so those both comics guys. It starts in Manchester 2011 at joint production of DC and Walter Lane Productions, the guys that did the Walking with Dinosaurs animatronic TV show.
Yeah.
So then it goes to America in 2012. The show is a mix of live actor stunt performances, pyrotechnics, video elements. It's a multi-million dollar production, 45 performers, 100-foot stage, blah, blah, blah. Gotham City's in there, Wayne Manor, Batcave, Arkham Asylum. The show opens with an Arkham Asylum jailbreak and has Batman and Robin against villains like the Joker, Catwoman, Riddler, Penguin, Two-Face, Harley Quinn. But basically what the story is centered on is Dick Grayson's transformation from, you know, orphan trapeze artist to the Boy Wonder. And how Batman and Robin kind of get along, and how Batman kind of sees his story of loss kind of paralleled in Robin. So, yeah, it'll be quite good. I'm curious. I mean, there's not going to be singing or all that kind of stuff. It's actually going to be, you know, like a proper stage show. I don't know how they do it, but it sounds pretty cool. I hope it comes to Australia. I'd see it.
You would?
Absolutely.
There'll be a lot of kids in there. It reminds me of the Warner Brothers movie world on the Gold Coast thing, to be honest. Like, the stuntmen jumping around.
This will be better. Hopefully it won't be lots of Mighty Morphin Power Ranging kind of posing and that kind of stuff. Hopefully it's more mature. Well, I mean, with, you know, Alan Burnett and Geoff Johns kind of doing the script, and with, you know, the loss of parents and as a theme and that kind of stuff, you'd think it would be a bit darker.
Well, you tell me how it is, and I don't think I'll be seeing this. You have like nephews and things, don't you?
Oh, dude, they're right getting into their superheroes now. So
take them along. That's perfect for them.
That's your excuse. As long as they keep quiet, then I'll take them.
That's right. So you'll be pretending it's like, oh, it's just for the kids, you know.
Get out, Batman.
Shut up.
Be quiet.
Batman's talking. Yeah. All right. We done.
Let's go on to, I think so. What have we been reading, watching? I watched recently Nikita, otherwise known as La Femme Nikita.
Not La Femme. Oh, I thought you meant the TV show Nikita. Okay, sorry. Go on.
Jumping the gun, as always. That's the problem of your generation. You don't wait for things to be explained to you.
Your problem is you take too long to explain
things. I was talking... so I watched Nikita, but yes, also known as La Femme Nikita. Released in 1990, written and directed by Luc Besson, who did Big Blue, Fifth Element.
Yeah.
Produced the Transporter trilogy, a whole bunch of films. A good director, generally speaking. There was a 1993 US remake starring Bridget Fonda, redhead girl.
Is she related to Jane Fonda?
Also known as her daughter. Also known as the assassin or point of no return, I think. There was a TV series on Nikita from 1997 to 2001. And that was called La Femme Nikita, starring Aussie Peter Wilson. And you're correct, there's a new series called Nikita. It just started, and that's starring Maggie Q.
Is that a remake of this old series?
They're all based on each other.
Ah, okay.
So, obviously the first film that I watched, the 1990 version, is where all these other TVs are. And it's a pretty good film, basically. Have you seen it before?
No.
Okay, it's basically about this drug addict who accidentally shoots a police officer. Well, she doesn't accidentally in the French film. She shoots a police officer, and then she kind of gets taken away instead of she gets killed or... Like, the world thinks that she's dead, but she actually gets trained for a couple of years by this underground secret agency that trains assassins. So she learns to fight guns and act like a lady and all that kind of stuff. And she kind of falls in love, and then she kind of thinks that she's left that life behind. And then one of the days she gets the, her new job with a new name and identity. She has to go out and kill people, et cetera, et cetera. It's pretty good, actually. It also stars Cheki Kayo. You know the guy I'm talking about?
No idea.
Google him. Once you see his face, you will know him.
Cheki Kayo. Okay.
I think he was in U571, maybe. It's actually a pretty good film. Lots of action and stuff. I mean, it's set in 1990, so obviously the fashion is, big mobile phones and that kind of stuff. But it's actually quite good. Some good, generally good action sequences in there as well. If you don't mind subtitles and you want something different, it's certainly a good film.
Awesome.
Right. I also watched the live-action 20th Century Boys, which I thought you'd be happy about.
Oh, yeah. What'd you think?
But we've talked about that before. Yeah, it's good. I mean, it's you probably said that it is like Lost, and I guess it is because it's a big cast, lots of time jumping back and forth. But, I liked it. I like the central idea behind it. These groups of kids kind of made up this story about these bad guys taking you over the world, and then decades later, what they kind of predicted or fantasized actually comes true.
Yeah.
So the kids reunite as adults to try and stop them.
Trying to track down, out which friend of theirs is doing it, basically. And I think the first film cuts off at a good spot. Like,
got a cliffhanger, which I found quite surprising. Because they must have thought, this film, the manga's so successful, so we're going to have to make three films at least. So let's be bold and end the first one on a cliffhanger.
It's a long manga, and I think it's just too much story to try and compress into one film. But I think, they cut it off at the right point, which is, really where the manga takes a turn. So, I think there's like three or four movies now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But it's got a few kind of Japanese-isms, like very strange kind of edits or just inappropriate music at times. I don't know if you felt that.
No, I didn't know.
Or overly dramatic performances. Overwrought.
But it's always kind of hard to tell when it's got subtitles.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah, I always wonder if the Japanese actors I do like are actually terrible, you know what I mean? Or when I'm watching Japanese manga, anime... I'm thinking, God, these voice actors are so much better than the English ones. But then I think, wait, maybe they're not. Maybe they're worse. Because you know what English voice actors sound like. An American manga? It's not good. So maybe they're just as bad. But I saw that movie as well. So it was okay,
Speaking on foreign films, I watched Black Lightning. It's not based on the DC Comics superhero, the guy who has the lightning powers, but this is produced by Timur Benkampatov, who did His next film was Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, based on the novel that he directed Wanted. So he's Russian, I guess. It's actually pretty good. It's basically about this teenager that finds a flying car, and then he basically fights crime, tries to find a girl. It's like a Disney film, but Timur was basically saying he wanted Russia to kind of have an American idealized superhero, like they just need to be reminded of what good is and what evil is. So, it's pretty good. I mean, the remake is scheduled, and it basically uses the elements of Iron Man and Spider-Man quite clearly. But it's pretty good. I mean, again, it's another subtitle film, but it's pretty harmless. You'll see it. There's like a teenager with a hoodie and a black 60s car flying on the cover. But, yeah, it's pretty good. It's a fairly new film. Quite enjoyable.
Okay.
I also watched Predators last night.
Oh, okay.
Have you seen that?
Nope. I thought you already watched this.
No, I haven't.
Okay.
No. It's only just been released.
That's a lie.
On DVD.
Oh, okay. All right.
Very passionate about it.
I know. I'm very angry about
it. Lie!
Liar!
How dare you? Two scenes I recognised that were kind of straight from the 1987 original, but and even the theme music, it's directed by Nimrod Antal, who did Vacancy, Kate Beckinsale, which is quite a good
horror movie.
Quite a good film. And Armored. Predator is pretty good. Yeah, a bunch of people get kidnapped on Earth, thrown on a Predator planet and basically hunted. But yeah, I still prefer the 1987 original.
Who doesn't?
But a good action film nonetheless. Get to the chopper.
I quite like the sequel with Danny Glover, but everyone seems to hate it.
I don't mind it either. Like, high-tech gangs running LA with funky weapons.
It introduced the disc, you know, that and the net gun and all the crazy weapons.
Oh, really? That wasn't in the first one.
No, it wasn't in the first one. And the disc was like the best thing about the second film.
Yeah.
And it also gave you Gary Busey.
And he's always good.
He's always good.
Yeah.
For TV shows, I've been watching Dexter, this season of Dexter, and it's about halfway to two-thirds.
Is this the latest one? He's got a kid or something? Is that
That's
the one?
Right. Yep. He had the baby in the last season, and the big cliffhanger of last season was his wife was murdered by the killer who he was stalking through the whole last season. And then that's how they left that season off, and it's like, his wife's dead. And that was quite, a huge deal. And it was always a huge problem that people... I was worried, now they have to try and follow this enormous... that's the problem with overdoing your big cliffhanger. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If it's that huge, you've really got to try and follow it. And this season's been okay, but just one of the more average seasons. It's basically centered around, now his kids have... the kids that weren't his... The baby's his. The other kids were her original kids from the last marriage. They've moved on. They're living with their grandma now, and it almost feels like they've used it as an excuse to retcon certain things out of the show.
Okay.
And that I don't care for. But he still has the baby, so it can focus on just him and the kid, which is quite good, because then he's the only parent raising this child, and he's like a serial killer, so he's got to cope with that. And the main quest of this show series just randomly came about, and it felt a bit too like, so now he's just involved in this thing. There's this girl who was kidnapped, and she wants to kill these guys and get back at them, and it seems like they're setting her up as a love interest, and it's Julia Stiles.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And meanwhile, what I've realized of Dexter is there's certain, and people who watch the show will know what I mean, any scenes with his work colleagues, Batista and Maria Lagueta, you can just skip those, because they're subplots which don't lead anywhere. So I literally just fast forward through those scenes. Any scene where Deb talks to White Dokes is the replacement for the original Dokes character who was killed off, and he was awesome, and they tried replacing him with this white character who's just not as good. And any scene where they talk to each other is just a waste of your time. Skip it, and the show becomes really tight. And
cool.
Is John
Lithgow in this season?
No, he died at the end of last season.
He was a bad guy, serial killer.
He was the bad guy, and he was great. Like, he was a guest star, which has been impossible to follow as well.
Yeah.
And it's okay. I still wouldn't recommend people check it out if you're new to the show. And I think the show's running out of steam pretty quickly. It's always had kind of dodgy writing at times, especially any scene which Dexter, Anthony Michael Hall, isn't in, because he really carries that show.
Yeah.
Yeah. But shall we talk about some comics?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
This week I read Mesmo Delivery, by Rafael Grampa, who I think is Argentinian. Does that sound right? Yeah. Argentinian or Brazilian. Newcomer. Recently, you saw his work in Marvel's Strange Tales 2, the first issue of that, where he did this Wolverine story, which has been rightfully praised across the board by everyone. Have you read that? I'm sure you have.
Yeah, that's the one where he's wrestling. And
yeah, they sort of redo the character that him and all the other kind of immortal X-Men are like prize fighters, and they kill each other night after night and come back. And Raphael really excels in scenes of violence. Like, he's got this very kinetic style. Visually, it's a lot like Paul Pope.
Yes, good comparison. Yeah. It's kind of fluid, organic,
I find in this Raphael's panels, there's a lot of internal movement, because the line work is at times, like, especially on the lips, I almost get a feeling like they're about to start wriggling around on the page. Very new school, just because everything's made up with these wiggly lines. The characters have always, not hatching, but those little lines that sort of make up their skin. And there's a real feeling of texture to this. And the story roughly is these two truckers arrive at this bus gas station. One of them gets in a fight with these guys and accidentally punches this girl in the face, kills her. And these guys try and then wrap... then they kill him and they try and... cover up the murder. And there's this crazed... Elvis lookalike guy who then kills them with these two knives. That's a pretty fair hack.
It's quite a hard story to describe. It's quite simple, but you kind of want to see more. Like, you want to see what happens next, or you want to see more about these characters. It's a very wild story, isn't
it? Yeah, it's really wild. And some of the action scenes, like when the Elvis guy jumps out, these enormous words, like lyrics of a song that he imagines playing in the background, are covering the page behind him. It just fills the page with activity and movement. And because he's a newcomer, it feels very fresh. I feel like we're going to be seeing a lot more of Rafael Grampa, so it's a good time to jump on board with his work. And this is just a pretty short read from Dark Horse. I would recommend picking it up.
It is. I have something also wild, but not as wild. It's Atomic Robo from publisher Red 5 Comics. They've been around for since about 2007. And Atomic Robo, who is their main character, I think. But you've read some Atomic Robo tales.
That's correct. Yeah, I read.
So basically, it's always the Atomic Robo series. It's not an ongoing series, but it's a series of mini series, usually four, five, six individual issues. Each issue is set in an individual time zone. So Atomic Robo is basically this mechanical man. He's got like blue eyes and but a metallic body, no mouth or eyes. But he's basically like, if Indiana Jones was a robot with the kind of the mad skills of Deadpool and the wit of Spider-Man, that was kind of be what Atomic Robo. He's like this scientist slash adventurer. He's created by Nikola Tesla, who's the real scientist. So this is the fifth volume, and the first issue has just been released. It's called A Deadly Art of Science. It opens in Chicago and later in New York in 1930. And so kind of Robo is kind of new. He's kind of just been created, I guess. This is early in his crime-fighting career. So it's already established crime fighters, and you can see him on the cover. His name is Jack Taro, gunfighter, and he's basically got like a little waistcoat and a tie and a bowler hat and a red mask covering his face, and he's a little six-shooter. Mm-hmm. So he teams up with his daughter. His daughter's Nightingale, who's kind of like an oracle. She kind of gives him guidance and assistance over their low-tech radio. So it opens up with a bit of a car chase with some mobsters and gangsters in Chicago. And, yeah, it's pretty good. And then Atomic Robo sees Taro kind of fly past, and he goes, wow, this is pretty cool. I want in. Can I be your partner? And kind of bugs him to be his partner, psychic slash protege. So, it's pretty good. It's funny. This is a five-issue miniseries. It makes complete sense to any newcomer. If you've never read any Atomic Robo before, you can jump right in. The writer is Brian Clevenger, and the artist is Scott Wegener. So those two guys have done Atomic Robo and nobody else has, so they've just got such a great feel for the character. It's really funny. Whenever I see Atomic Robo, I always pick it up because it's just such a light-hearted read. It's an all-ages read as well, and the art is just great. Very expressive, kind of not cartoony, but it's very good. I really like it. If you don't like Atomic Robo, there's something wrong with you. Atomic Robo, Volume 5, Number 1, The Deadly Art of Science from Red 5 Comics. Pick it up now.
Are you saying there's something wrong with me, Chris?
Why, did you say you didn't like it?
I don't dislike it. It's just not my kind of deal. Not my kind of thing.
I like it, I guess, because I read so many comics, and this is it's not a superhero book. It doesn't take itself seriously. Mm. It's very tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
It's something that'll just bring a smile to your face just in reading it. And it's not something where you have to, like, if you pick up issue 3 of this series, you don't have to think, what happened in issue 1 and 2? I mean, it's got an introductory page on each issue anyway, but it's not so complicated that it's like trying to read a black and white newspaper in a fog.
I agree with you. Yeah.
It's clear storytelling.
I feel like it it does what your superhero comics should be doing, but better.
Yeah.
That adventure and that sort of deal. So it's good work in that genre. So yeah, cool stuff. The other book I read and I sent you some pictures of was 676 Apparitions of Killoffer.
That is a good name.
Yeah, which is by Patrick Killoffer, who's a French artist, comic book artist, I suppose. And he put this out in 2002, and there was an English translation where he did all the lettering in about 2005, which is what I'm reading now through Typocrat Press. It's quite big book. Physical size is similar to it's smaller than that Wednesday Comics reprint, just a bit smaller than that, so it's quite huge.
Okay.
And it's a good book to flip through as well, because what he does is he doesn't resort to normal panels. The spaces are framed by furniture, and it's all very haphazard. And what happens very quickly is he's doing some sort of report in Quebec, I believe, and he's bringing girls home and that sort of thing. And because of the repetitiveness of what he's doing, 676 versions of him appear in his apartment, and they start. Then they all have his vices. They're all smokers. They are all bit partyish, disheveled kind of. They all have the 6 o'clock, 5 o'clock shadow. And you know that saying, like, if you ever meet your clone, that what are the two things you should do with them, Chris?
Yep, make love
or fight.
And okay.
Yeah, and both those things happen. And there's these wild scenes where he comes home and the whole house has descended into this orgy, and they're all naked. And then they try and force him to take part, and he fights them off quite brutally. And then he cooks up this plan on how to get rid of them, and it descends into this wild nihilistic page of himself. You know, all of these versions of himself gutting each other with broken bottles, and it's incredibly violent. So it's not for the faint-hearted, and I'd say it's got that sort of feeling of it's a very kind of pessimistic, dark comic. There's some very dark stuff that happens through it, and the stuff that his doubles do. So you get a feeling of what's he delving into, like the author's delving into these really dark parts of his psyche. If he had no inhibitions and what he hates about himself, it's very hateful, self-hateful. Thing.
So it's nothing like that Michael Keaton film, Duplicity. Was that what it was called?
You know, it's a lot like Duplicity. Yeah, there's a funny one, and Andy McDowell's in this too. Yeah, that was a kind of remake of this, maybe. I don't know. Cool. Wouldn't it be strange if it was like someone read that and go, "We should make this into a film," but not and change it up completely.
So it's kind of got black humor and
there's a fair bit of black
humor.
It is funny at times, and it just gets to this point where it's just so wild that you just have to laugh, you know, like when him like three of his doubles are beating up a bouncer and with this girl in the park, and it's quite unpleasant. And it all starts where he comes back to his apartment after being away for so long, and because he left his sink full of dirty dishes, all the sludge from that kind of warps all over him and spawns all these doubles. So there's humor in it, yeah. I definitely recommend picking it up if you're into European comics at all or anything experimental, because the composition and the way the story's told, it's mostly wordless, actually. So it fits into our wordless comics thing, but it's all very, it's new, it feels very fresh, and it's very original. I'd say it's one of the independent comics that you should have read from the last 10 years, and it's taken me this long to catch up to it, and I thoroughly recommend it if you're into, who we were talking about before, Black Hole, Charles Burns, or anyone that. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, check it out.
Something completely different.
Yep.
Toy Story. Tales from the Toy Chest.
They have things in common.
This is from Beam Studios. They've been doing Toy Story stuff, a lot of Disney stuff as well, Muppets. We talked about Muppets Sherlock Holmes recently. So this is actually a good jumping on point. This is Tales from the Toy Chest number 2, but if you haven't read number 1, don't worry about it. This makes complete sense. It's written by Jesse Blaze Snyder, a very good writer who's done Muppets work before. He's also done, recently he did a Hulk Let the Battle Begin one-shot, which had Hulk fighting Thor and was somewhat controversial amongst fanboys online, but it was definitely a good Marvel one-shot. So basically this is set kind of in, well, it's set after the events of Toy Story 2, so we don't have the Toy Story 3 characters here yet. And basically Andy is still a little kid and he takes the toys on a cruise ship. And it's got some pretty good scenes. It seems like a simple premise, but it's pretty cool that the toys are on the plane getting jostled about and they play I Spy and Andy's carry-on luggage. And they arrive on the cruise ship. They try to entertain themselves and they get a bit bored. So they go, they kind of sneak out into the ship alone and go to the ship's bow. And I don't think I'm spoiling anything, but one of the toys falls overboard. The title is Toy Overboard, so I don't think I'm spoiling anything. But, yeah, it's pretty good. The art is by Morgan Luthy, who's done Wally comics before, as well, also for Boom. And there's an interview with him in the last page of this comic. The art style is obviously not as clean and crisp as, you know, Pixar's sheeny CGI look, but it's a bit more sketchy and loose, but obviously all the characters are very familiar and still look like as they should look. It's pretty good. I mean, Jesse Blaze Snyder's he's got such a great knack for understanding the voices of the characters, and even jaded fanboys like us will still have a soft spot in their hearts for the Toy Story characters. And they just ring true, you know, so there's Andy and Bars and Jesse and the Potato Head married couple, and also they all speak so well. A lot of humour. It's another good kind of all ages book that you could certainly read to your nieces or nephews or assorted brood that you may have at home. This is just a mini series. So it's Toy Story Tales from the Toy Chest number 2, and that is out as we speak from Boom Studios.
Speaking of another comic that's currently out, The Unwritten through Vertigo, which is a series by Mike Carey, who used to work on Hellblazer and also wrote the Lucifer series for them.
Yes.
Which was a kind of a spin-off of Sandman. For those who don't know, I just want to mention it because it's a cool series to check out, Lucifer. In Sandman, the devil, you know, Lucifer decides because he was originally punished and that's how he was sent to, you know, become the keeper of hell. He decides he's had enough and he hands the keys over to Sandman in the comic. And Sandman becomes the Lord of Hell for a short period. Not that he wants to, he's kind of tricked into it. And the comic follows him in his sort of everyday sort of solving problems kind of thing. So it's an interesting hero for that comic. And for fans of that, The Unwritten also follows that feeling of this kind of supernatural exploring ideas, exploring concepts. And in this one, a character called Tommy Taylor, or Tom Taylor...
Yes.
Who's also a comic book writer or artist, writer?
He's a writer of Star Wars Invasion.
That's
and also
it,
the Boba Fett miniseries. A good guy. We've both met him.
Have we? Dude. Have I met him?
Yep. At the Gestalt. We went to that pub that time.
I don't remember.
I don't know if you introduced yourself.
Okay. Fair enough.
I just ignored you and pretended not to be your friend.
Was he wearing like a baseball cap?
That was so long ago.
Okay, fair enough.
You can recall these things.
Doesn't matter, I guess.
So this is what Unwritten, this is the first two trades that
First two trades of it, and I think there's only been two trades out so far, and the series is still ongoing. A character called Tommy Taylor, who he's famous for his father, who wrote a whole bunch of Harry Potter-esque adventures starring, except instead of Harry Potter, it was Tommy Taylor, and he named the character after his son, or that's what everyone's been told. So he's sort of... he goes around signing books and stuff, and he's always been associated in people's minds with this character. And he, through a series of unfortunate events, he gets accused of murder, like these quite brutal murders of these, there's a house full of horror writers who are having like a writer's workshop, and they're all murdered one by one.
Okay.
So that's the kind of attitude of this book. It's kind of pokes fun at this sort of, writers and themselves and the stories they write, and he's accused of it, so everyone kind of hates him now. He's become almost the Antichrist because people feel betrayed by their child. Imagine if Harry Potter murdered a bunch of people, you know?
Yeah.
And then all the parents of the children are like, "You monster!" And in the series, it's crazy. Like, he goes to prison and he starts to realize that there is a connection between him and the fictional character, and he has these sort of powers that he's not aware of. and it's more the literary things are real and they manifest themselves in our reality through, like, words have power is the magical concept. You know, when you say words, they do have a power. And when you write them and people believe them, they sort of come true. And
sounds like a very Grant Morrison philosophy.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, yeah, you can't look at these stories and not think of Grant Morrison and Neil Gaiman. And so Mike Carey has his own approach to it, which I appreciate. And I love any comic which has a prison sequence, like an extended scene within a prison. I've always liked that in films. And, and there's a bit where they go into this world which is resulted from this Nazi propaganda. And he meets Goebbels, and it's and he gets shot, and yeah, it's crazy. It's got some really wild sequences. There's a bit towards the end of the second volume, which is almost like a sequence from Fables, because this guy pissed off the dad, who's disappeared now, and he sends him into basically like a Winnie the Pooh reality as a rabbit, and the guy's like this violent guy trying to escape from it, and all the animals, "Hello there, Mr. Rabbit, how are you?" And he's like, "I'm going to murder you cocksuckers," you know. Can I say that on the air?
Well, it's far too late for that. we're not on the air as such.
On the internet air. But yeah, the main drawback of this series is the art. I've got to be honest, I do not care for it.
I was going to ask you, who's the artist?
By Peter Gross. And I've never seen his work before, but it's really not not anything special. I feel like he's a bit haphazard. Towards the end of the second volume, there's a vast improvement in the art, and it almost feels like a time issue. So I hope he gets better over the course of it, but really so far that's been my main problem with it, and it's almost, sometimes it's to the point where it's difficult to, not difficult to comprehend, but it's just not enjoyable to read.
Okay.
So, for a Vertigo comic, it's very disappointing on that level. But the story is very good. It's probably one of the best ongoing stories they have. So, why does this always happen? Why do series of stories I like have really not good art? Why must it be that way?
That's a very deep and profound question that I cannot give a satisfactory answer to.
And early Vertigo had that problem as well. You like, you know, the old Swamp Thing, and occasionally even Sandman, just the art was not good. And it was a major problem with reading those stories back. So I think Peter Gross is getting better, because the second volume, the art improves, and I'm hoping it keeps improving.
Yeah.
It might actually end up being good. And the last book I had, I'll save for next week, because I want to read more volumes of it. Do you have anything else?
I wanted to talk about Halcyon, H-A-L-C-Y-O-N, Halcyon number one from Image Comics, which is apparently a new ongoing series. Originally it was called Utopia, the name change. And basically the tagline of such is, what happens when the superheroes win? So, you know, all the good guys have won, there's no more crime, what's next? Essentially, that's the setup of the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's written by Mark Guggenheim, who's done a lot of DC work. He's written Superman, Batman, some of the best issues of Superman, Batman, actually. He's working on the Green Lantern live-action film as we speak. And also Tara Butters, who did a TV series called Reaper. The artist is Ryan Bondenheim, who did Red Mass for Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And so you feel like the kind of fluid and slightly kinetic style, not as much as, say, Raphael Graber, of course.
But, I'd say his style's got a static approach to the actual art. There isn't a lot of... There's never any movement lines, per se, or anything like that. But the action, I get what you mean by kinetic in that sense. Like, there's a lot of action sequences. He has more of a Frank Quitely sort of feeling of...
Frank Quitely, that's a good example. There's a fair bit of detailed line work, and it's quite intricate, but still kind of organic. Halcyon is like the name of the Justice League of America kind of version in this world that Halcyon, the series, represents. They meet in an underwater base, and it's pretty cool because some of them, there's a speedster, and he just has a projection of himself, like, you know, kind of like a Star Wars projection, 3D dimension, as he's going around saving people from burning buildings, that kind of stuff. So basically it's in a superhero world, kind of like The Authority, published by DC Comics, or Wildstorm, but not as in your face, not as adult, not as much blood and profanity. Well, there is a bit of blood in here, but it's still kind of tame compared to the standards of The Authority.
Mm-hmm.
So the two main characters would be this guy Sabre, who's kind of like the Batman equivalent, and Zenith, who's kind of like a female version of Superman. Not Wonder Woman, but a female version of Superman. So she's kind of the best superhero in the world, whereas Sabre, the Batman one, is a lot more darker and stuff. So they kind of have this friendship, and then they end up sleeping together. But yeah, it's actually a pretty good series. I didn't expect to like it because we've seen so many of these realistic superheroes. They're over the top, and you know that we've seen how many series like this already. Mm-hmm. But this is actually quite a good series. It opens with this guy called Jarhead, who's like a super soldier, kind of like a version of Captain America, but without the patriotic super costume, and he's just ripping people, Afghanistan's soldiers' limbs apart and stuff. You don't really know. He kind of appears at the start and then at the end of the comic, and I don't really know why. So I guess that'll have more of an explanation in later issues. But it's a good setup. There's a bad guy called Oculus, the would-be ruler of the world, as he's described here. And basically, he has a bit of a meeting with all the alternate versions of himself. Mm-hmm. Imagine all the alternate Lex Luthers and stuff, so they all meet and kind of begrudgingly get along, and Oculus kind of knows that something is happening, so he basically surrenders at the end of the comic, but yeah, it's actually pretty good. So all these, the Halcyon, the JLA guys know that crime is decreasing, so the only thing that's keeping them busy as of late is accidents, flaming buildings and bridge collapsing and that kind of stuff. So there are some superhero battles in here. There's a bit of kind of nudity, but, the females here are covering the naughty bits. It's pretty good. It's quite a bold take. It's not one for the kids, but it's I'm curious to see it. So far, it's a good setup. If you're bored with Nemesis, the Mark Miller series that came out recently, it's on its second issue at the moment. If you want more of a kind of subdued and not such I don't want to use the word obnoxious, but not mm-hmm. such an in-your-face kind of approach to Nemesis or the Authority, then Halcyon number one from Image Comics is the way to go.
Cool. I think it's about time we got into this Grant Morrison doco.
Yeah, so seen from this particular perspective, which apparently was outside time, the entirety of life on Earth and every single little mitochondrial cell that divided through the entirety of life on Earth was seen as one object, extended. It was that sense of a higher enfolding reality. I saw it as inhabited and intelligent and conscious.
And suddenly this giant column of light comes through the door. Now, bear in mind that I'm hallucinating, but this was one of the most amazing hallucinations I've ever had. And it's Jesus.
I am not the God of your fathers, I am the hidden stone that breaks all hearts.
And the documentary that's been doing the rounds at the moment is a production semi-produced by Seek Art or Sequart.
Yep.
A shortening of sequential art if you want to look them up. They used to have an ongoing kind of blog and website, and that stopped, and they started focusing on books and critical analyses of works by famous artists and creators. Among those was Grant Morrison, and a writer there did a book on the early career of Grant Morrison, looking at his early work up to, I think, and including The Invisibles. And what they've done now is produced a film called Talking with Gods. And Grant Morrison, you may know as the mastermind behind most of DC's events at the moment. So
yes, he's the bald, skinny, Scottish writer. Mm-hmm. He's done JLA in the mid-90s. He kind of revitalized JLA, but he's done We Three, Sea Guy, mm-hmm. A whole bunch of...
Animal Man,
Batman,
The Invisibles.
Robin, yeah. Animal Man. So he's done a lot of superhero stuff, but also he tends to specialize in the more off-kilter.
Yes. He also did, what was it, Arkham Asylum? That very famous...
Arkham Asylum he did. Yeah. Like you mentioned, The Invisibles.
Yes.
It's...
Yeah, this doco sort of breaks down the history of his career in comics, and also his working process through interviews with artists who work with him quite regularly. So there's, is it Frank Quitely's in it, isn't he? Yeah.
Frank Quitely's in it.
Another Scotsman.
Yes. Yeah.
There's interviews of all sorts. Warren Ellis pops up, Dan Didio, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, he was in there for a little bit. Jeff Johns is in there, Mark Waid, Jill Thompson. There's a pretty... good names. Jason Aaron, should actually mention that Sekhar are doing a Warren Ellis documentary that should be coming out next year. It's called Captured Ghost, so yes. Same kind of approach, same kind of subject, but a different slightly approach visually. It's an 80-minute documentary, it's all about Grant Morrison. If you don't know who Grant Morrison is, obviously this isn't going to change your mind or whatever. This is a film for fanboys. Mm-hmm. So if you're not familiar with his work, if you haven't read any of his stuff, mm-hmm. it's probably worth you bypassing this.
Right.
Essentially, it's a lot of Talking Heads, most of them seem to be filmed at Comic-Con last year,
who
offer kind of insights into Morrison's life. Not a lot will be known necessarily about him that you can't perhaps find online, but I did find it interesting. I actually watched it twice because it's only 80 minutes, so you can certainly it kind of gets it all down into the bare nuggets that you need to know. So it talks about his Flex Metallus series that was based on his kind of tough, mustachioid father, his time as a kid in hospital, the time he first started learning magic at 19 from his uncle, who was really into dark magic and that kind of stuff, his fight with Alan Moore that I found kind of interesting.
Yeah, I had no idea about that.
Not a physical fight, but a kind of... and the notebooks that he always keeps around at all times.
Yeah.
And then kind of the work that he did, Zenith, which is the first superhero for 2000 AD, which then got him noticed on Vertigo Comics in the late 80s, which then put him onto Animal Man. And he's actually a pretty good artist as well. I didn't realise, like, I mean, he first started as a young kid, as a teenager, selling his stories as a writer and artist. Now
that's
he's
right.
just known as a writer.
He came to a crossroads where he kind of had to pick one or the other, and that's how mainstream comics work in the US, unfortunately. For Grant, I guess, because he wasn't a great artist, but he was okay. I think he would have kept developing. The whole doco itself felt like almost a lot of hyperbole about how great he is. Like there were a few too many talking heads of people just praising him, and I wanted more insight into what he's. There was a fair bit of insight into what he's like, and all the stories you hear about Grant Morrison and the magic and weird stuff he does. Even he, even like someone will say something, and they'll cut to him going, "You know, a lot of this stuff is just people exaggerate a bit because there's a bit of a myth about the character I play at conventions and real life isn't the real me, you know." But then there's other stuff that he has done. Like I thought it was interesting to realize I knew a lot of Invisibles, especially, was stuff that he himself was doing. So if there was a character who's a crossdresser, he spent several months as a crossdresser, you know. And he traveled the world, and that was a moment of release for him because there's no expectations of him acting like he always did. So he could try all these things he'd never done before. And, I mean, they talk about he mentioned some of the drugs he does and, you know, those kind of things that he's famous for. And some of that I thought was interesting in that he was like, you know, I've never done crack because, you know, that's a dangerous one. And I'm like, that's interesting, you know.
Yeah.
And he's kind of a reasonable guy at times. Like, I thought almost he's still very shy. Even if he is like this big wild character, he came across to me as someone who's very keeps himself. There's certain aspects of himself that he doesn't reveal to people, and that this doco almost doesn't quite get into that level of closeness that you expect from a doco about someone. About
yes, I agree. Yeah. I did want to know more about him, like his writing style, his influences. Who does he like as a writer? You know, what kind of films does he watch? What's his favourite comics that he reads from other people or his own work? That kind of stuff.
Yes.
We do get a few anecdotes, but nothing as revealing as we'd expect.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's not a huge, massive. I mean, production. I mean, I know documentaries are in vogue at the moment, but this is a low budget affair, so most of it is just talking heads with Grant Morrison either at his home or you know walking
and stills from the comics. Kind of
interspersed with the comic stuff, which I think they did well. They must have done a lot of research just to find because the comic work as he's speaking, he lines up the parallels quite nicely. He'll be talking about the Invisibles and this dream on LSD or whatever he had where
the directly,
silver blobby creatures took him in, and then they'll show that kind of panel from the Invisibles. And I mean, he's quite open about all his drug use and whatnot and his magic and all the visions he had and this kind of stuff. I didn't realise how much of his own experiences were written, like you said, into his work. So I found that quite interesting.
Yeah, that stuff's fascinating for sure.
But there was more I wanted to know more, like the time he met Robbie Williams, you know, because he was saying All-Star Superman, you know, when people meet Superman, in reality it'd be like meeting a god, a celebrity, a father, a politician, a general in one. And they're saying, you know, the first time when he met Robbie Williams, because I think Frank Quietly did a cover, because Robbie Williams is a fan of The Invisibles, apparently.
Okay.
So a couple of years ago, Frank Quietly, friend of Morrison and a frequent collaborator, did a artwork for Robbie Williams cover, so he met him, but that's all he said. I was like curious to know more about that kind of stuff. We didn't get a lot to know about his upbringing.
I think you got a fair amount actually. the stories of his dad. He was like an anti-nuclear activist, and they'd sneak onto like military bases and things to get
that
photos.
That was interesting. I guess I was kind of wanting more, like you know, when he was a teenager, when he's kind of giving his band a shot, and then when he was trying to break into comics. And
I think the point is he's kind of normal. Journey. I think he is kind of almost very, those years are probably very mundane and probably not too interesting because he's right. Like, you know, my parents both loved me. He doesn't have this dark upbringing. And what he was saying about the magic stuff I thought was interesting in that, yeah, he sort of, he almost at times was saying things like, you know, it's not like he fully believes in the gods and things. He's just like, these things work and I don't care why they work. They just work for me and they inspire me and that, and yeah, he even said a few things that were like, okay, so he's not fully like a literalist, like weirdo magician. He's just...
Yeah, which is kind of what I expected. So that did reveal something like he's not as out there and not as firm in his beliefs as I thought. He just magic is something that he does because he thinks that it works on the odd occasion.
It worked for him. And, you know, he's got these little stories how he helped his friend find his guitar through magic and all this stuff. And the sigil, remember how those work?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that was hilarious. Yeah, if you probably might have heard of sigils through Invisibles, but I won't spoil how they work because that's pretty hilarious. And there's a great story about when him and who was he meeting with? Anyway, they were trying to work out what to do with All-Star Superman. And then they saw this... either a cosplayer, I guess they're in LA, so it was one of those guys who's hired to walk around as Superman, and they went up and talked to him, and because he was just sort of so relaxed and comfortable in his skin, and they was like, you know, I'd always thought of Superman as this guy who just poses and stuff, but he was just this guy who was comfortable and powerful, and, you know, and they asked him, you know, how do you feel about Batman? And then the guy would give him serious answers, and he was like, this is great, and he's writing it down, and he uses
it. Character.
Yeah, and that's his approach to his storytelling is... things that happen in his life go directly into it, not and then later less so because he just works from his office after a while. And I've noticed, I've liked his work less since then. You know, like his current DC output does feel a bit more insular. Like he's just letting his imagination work.
He did Final Crisis, which was the big DC crossover event where Batman died and stuff last year, perhaps the year before. Yeah. And he kind of it's the first time in his career where he kind of. People didn't love him as much, and I was surprised at his reaction that he almost felt hurt and kind of not betrayed, but he's like almost taken aback by that people didn't like Final Crisis, and it was pretty unwieldy. But
was it? Yeah, because his thing was he wanted it to be challenging, and he was like, you got to meet. He almost felt like he wanted them to beat him halfway. Like he almost felt I could bring this up to the next level of really making people think and challenge themselves, but no one was ready to. Or that's how he took it anyway. I haven't read the event, so I don't know. I don't know if you agree with him or whether you think it just is unwieldy and not very good.
Yes, but it is unwieldy. It's a bit hard to get into. But I mean, he has a good grasp and always has of the bigness and the epicness of superheroes. And that's why his run on JLA from about, I think, 95, 96 he started. And if you can pick up any of Grant Morrison's Justice League of America trade paperbacks, then certainly do, because it's superhero storytelling at its finest.
Yeah.
This is... it's a DVD. It's being distributed by Haley 8, who do the God Killer motion comic. There's a trailer for that on the DVD, as well as a trailer for The Third Age, which is the live-action web series by the director of this Talking Gods documentary, Patrick Meaney, who actually interviewed BrokenFrontier.com recently. There's not any special features or anything. But
I think they said there will be. I thought they said there would be special features, or is that not the case at all? None.
There's not on the DVD. I don't know if they're going to do a Blu-ray or whatever, but DVD, there's only the trailers.
Because they were talking about special features to try and give an extra incentive to keep people from downloading it and that sort of thing. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. How do you think this compares to other docos of the type, like Jonathan Roth's Steve Ditko?
I have yet to watch that, and I haven't seen the Mindscape of Alan Moore is the other one that comes to mind.
Okay.
I haven't seen that either.
Yeah.
But, it's interesting, actually, because... before I forget, he does mention that he got a $120,000 royalty check on Arkham Asylum. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Arkham Asylum was the, 1988-89 graphic novel that came out. I guess it was the equivalent to Superman Earth 1 in its day.
Except, like, with art by, what was it, Dave McKean?
Dave McKean, yeah.
Yeah, of who does all the Sandman covers. So, and it, the, yeah, really cool book to check out if you're into arty kind of comics. Yeah. But as a docker, I won't say it'll make you a fan of his work. I thought they kind of did a poor job almost of really telling you what's great about or what's special about his work. Unlike, like that Steve Ditko documentary I mentioned, it made you curious about wanting to read his work. Same with that Mobius documentary I mentioned a couple of weeks ago.
Okay,
that also made you curious about his work because they presented it in an interesting way. And I guess it's because they're artists, it's easier. But I might have mentioned that Harlan Ellison documentary, Dreams of Sharp Teeth.
Oh, okay, yes.
And that really makes you interested in the guy's work. And he's a writer as well. And I thought this didn't quite do that. It was just a bit too hyperbolic of them just praising how great he is rather than sort of giving you a feeling of why he's great.
Yeah.
And what would have actually helped was there was this in the Harlan Ellison doco, there were scenes where he just read passages from his books dramatically, and you got the feeling of, oh, this is what he's like, and this is what his work's like. And this almost needed that, of him just sort of reading a passage of something, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Mm.
Yeah, if you're already a fan of Morrison, it's worth watching, but if you're not, avoid it.
That's good.
But it's good, and I hope more come. I'm curious to see the Warren Ellis one, and we don't get enough stuff like this where it's just pretty the opportunity to be revealing and creators could kind of speak for themselves. So it's good on Sekou Art for doing this.
Cool. Our website of the week, we both actually picked without knowing the other person would pick it, which was bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
The site's called...
What did Morrison say about that? It has been kind of on the news in the... Member Sophia this week.
Sure. The site's called Our Valued Customers. It's pretty simply presented. It's on Blogspot.
It's called ourvaluedcustomers.blogspot.com.
Easy to find. Just Google that. And the guy works in a comic shop, and what he does is he overhears either things people say directly to him, or he overhears them talking to each other, and he makes a note of it and draws them saying that thing. It's a very cute kind of single panel comic thing that he does, I think, every day. And some of the comments are hilarious. He's got them sorted by creeps, crazies, jerks, fighters, and just folks. And I guess to give you a better feeling of it, we should just read out some of them. Okay, here's one to his friend regarding a plastic Thor hammer replica we had for sale. I wish I could get my hands on the real Thor hammer. I'd take it to work and lay waste to everyone in the whole hospital. Your turn, Chris.
Well, I'm just trying to... find some that they should do a zombie Muppet comic where they're all killing each other and stuff. That'd be epic.
This is a good one, and I'll bleep it out. This is to the child that he came into the store with. How the f*** haven't you seen Toy Story 3? Shit, you gotta get on that shit. So you get a feeling of like, and he makes them look like doofuses or just crazies, and it's very funny, so go check it out.
Don't you think that Invisible Girl is hot? Man, I really like her, like a lot. What do you think? Yeah, stuff like that. So, I mean, I don't know how many of these are realistic. Like, how many
I think they're real.
Or kind of exaggerated somewhat. I mean,
I can imagine in a very busy comic store, you'd get all sorts of nut jobs.
Maybe he just has a good memory. But, it is pretty funny. I haven't seen, I mean, most, I always, whenever I go into my comic shops, if there's someone talking it to the counter, I'll just butt myself into the conversation because I think it's a nice way to, it's a good way to meet people. I've met some good people there. Yeah, everyone's really friendly at the comic shops, you know, like even if you're not a regular buyer, and they're not always talking about geeky stuff, but it is a good place to see.
I
in a bathrobe once and put a bit of rope as a belt.
Ooh.
I don't know if he was like a low-range Jedi or something. But.
Maybe he was maybe he lives in the apartment above. Who knows? Oh, here's a good one. This one, I've actually had a conversation very much like this. I'm going to get a comic book tattoo, but I don't really know anything about comics, so what's a good one to get as a tattoo? Like, facepalm material. So,
yes, I have a Superman tattoo, I should point out.
Yeah, but so you know who Superman is.
That conversation wasn't with me. It is pretty good. And it's good that at least nerds can laugh at each other. I wonder if any of these people will recognize themselves.
One looks like Jerry Seinfeld. I don't know if that's intentional.
He loves Superman.
Yeah, I'm sure he does.
All right. Well, that's it for this week.
Whew.
Episode 15.
Wow. Okay.
Before we know it, we'll be at episode 16.
Okay. I think next week we should finally do our detectives feature.
I was going to say the very same thing.
Oh, what's the deal with us today? We're just on the same page, kind of.
Yep. We've both got beards and everything.
Sort of.
maybe. Do you have a beard this week?
It's not growing as fast as I'd have liked for November. It's very embarrassing. Oh, one thing I do want to mention, and this is for anyone living in Perth, New Year's Eve, you should head down to DeVille's Pad. They are doing a Batman-themed New Year's Eve.
Oh, I read something about that, but I was like, what the? Okay, cool. I am good. So, what, you have to be dressed as Batman, or?
You don't have to be, but it's the kind of place it is. It's only 25s and older. But if you're kind of mature and not a douchebag, they'll let you in, you know, if you're under 25. Sure. I'm 24 and they let me in, so that's fine. And, yeah, they it's a pretty wild place. The place is done up like hell. There's like caverns and these fake rock walls and these lights and the dance floors, like this lava pit. It's a pretty mad kind of looking place. Pretty relaxed, really quite a nice vibe there. And I would recommend going for New Year's because everyone's going to be going as Batman. And
so they've got all alternate universe Batman doing the Bat-2-C in hell.
Yes. The whole place has this 60s retro thing going on, so there's going to be a lot of 60s Adam West era villains. And on the poster for the event, they had a picture of Egghead, so the Vincent Price character. So we should be seeing some cool outfits. Shelley's going as Poison Ivy.
Oh, nice.
I've been contemplating whether to go as Crazy Quilt or... you know Crazy Quilt, don't you?
Yeah.
That'd be a fun one because I just have to get any items of clothing and chuck them on myself, kind of. I think I could pull that off.
I might go as Robin with my green shorts and pixie boots.
You would make the best Robin.
I'd pick up so many girls' phone numbers. I'd have to make a belt pouch just for the phone numbers. Mm.
My friend suggested everyone in our group go as Robin. So there's like 12 of us all at the door at the same time and filling the place up. And that's fine because there are a lot of Robins.
Well, one could go as Robin, one could go as Nightwing, one could go as Batman to kind of show...
If we all go as identical Robins and just latch ourselves onto people for the night, I'll be your sidekick for this evening, sir. They'll think we're waiters, actually, if we all go as Robin. I would assume that would be the waiter outfit, I think.
No, that would be Alfred.
Mm. And expect go-go dancers, because they always have go-go dancers at DeVille's. So I thoroughly recommend everyone check it out.
Thanks for listening, everybody. You can see all of our podcasts on iTunes on Mixcloud.
Mm-hmm.
All right, extrasequential.com. If you want to email us, please do so at Chris with a K, chris@extrasequential.com. My blog is comicbookjesus.com.
Music for the show is purgeaudit.com, and that wraps us up. So you'll be hearing us next week. See ya.
Bye-bye.